You're listening to Tectonic, a production of WFMU in Jersey City, New Jersey. Tectonic covers our shift to a digital future, exploring technology, how it affects us, and what we can do about it. And now, today's episode. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst, I'll be your host for the next hour or so. Such a pleasure to be with you, thanks for joining. We're going to be talking about widening inequality for this show, and I'm going to be speaking with a writer named Dan Carell, and I want to give you a little context before I start up this interview. You might remember I spoke with Megan Greenwell a few weeks ago, author of a book called Bad Company, about private equity and its role in the economy. And I wanted to focus on that because, as I said at the beginning of that show, the reality of inequality in the U.S. and in other countries as well is part of the story of the rise of the tech industry, dominated by these five or so companies, collectively known as big tech, that engage in surveillance, deception, manipulation in order to pursue growth at any cost. Today's show is a follow-up in a way because we're going to be talking about inequality with a focus on how the big tech platforms, specifically the use of surveillance, is playing a role. And we're going to be speaking about this with Dan Carell using a somewhat unusual case study. Here's the story. Dan Carell wrote a piece for the New York Times not long ago, you'll hear about it, and it's about Disney World, which is the giant theme park in Orlando, Florida. And what you're going to hear is that using Disney World as a kind of a case in point for the entire economy, we can see how the middle class is disappearing and what is being put back in its place is a two-tier system. It's almost a feudal system of aristocracy and peasants, or haves and have-nots, however you want to describe it. Perhaps you have experienced some of this in your own life. I mean, have you noticed that food has gotten a lot more expensive recently and healthcare is getting more expensive and travel is more expensive and a lot of just basic realities of you know, cost of living are just becoming out of reach? And you have to wonder, who's making all of this extra money that we're paying into these various services and products and platforms? Another way of asking that same question is, who's accumulating all the power in our system right now? And for that, I would just ask you, did you notice the destruction of the East Wing of the White House recently? Have you heard anything about that? Have you seen the photos? It has turned out that there are some very well-heeled donors who have contributed to the destruction of the East Wing. And five of the prominent donors to that project are Amazon, Apple, Google, Facebook, and Microsoft. In other words, more or less the same crew that we saw standing behind the current occupant at the inauguration in early 2025. And so in the economy today, which is dominated by big tech, a lot of the money and power is rolling up into those five companies. Of course, other companies are making use of the platforms of those big tech companies to enrich themselves and pursue their own growth at any cost agenda. And as we're going to hear from Dan Carell, the surveillance technology plays a part in that economic change and in the widening inequality that results. So I want to play you this interview with Dan Carell. Again, the story is set at Disney World, but this is not about Disney or Disney World. I want you to keep that in mind. This is about what's happening in the economy and specifically the role of the tech companies in pulling this off. And we're just using Disney World as an example because I thought it exemplified it well. If you'd like pointers to the story, there's a gift link to the Times story on the playlist. Go to tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. and click the playlist link for the Widening Inequality episode. Let's go ahead now and listen to my interview with Dan Carell here on Tectonic. Dan Carell, welcome to Tectonic.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Great to have you on the show. Not too long ago, you wrote a piece in the New York Times. It was about the widening inequality in our tech-dominated economy. The piece is called Disney and the Decline of America's Middle Class from August 28, 2025. I'll put a link to that on the playlist for today's show. In this article, you're telling a story of two families' trips to Disney World in Orlando, Florida, and their very different experiences at the same theme park. Let's start with Scarlett Kressel, a 60-year-old bus driver who saved up for years to bring her family to Disney World. What happened with her trip?
I'll start by saying Scarlett is terrific. I spent so much time talking to her, and she is a lifelong Disney fan. So, and that matters because she is a sophisticated player in terms of how to do this. Now, all of that, as people may know, for Disney actually matters a lot. But when you step back and think about it, is a little crazy. In other words, that not only does it cost money and all this, but that you actually have to really know how to work the system in order to make the thing work. Scarlett spent several years saving and then solidly 6 to 9 months planning with precision, right? These are trips that increasingly arguably have to be planned down to the hour, if not the minute, of each day. And so she brought a pretty large, it was her grandchildren, daughter, a family friend, her mom. I think there were 8 people ultimately that went into the park. The logistics of doing it on a budget are very difficult because you can solve every problem and arguably not have to plan the thing at all if you spend the most money. If you spend the most money, you stay on property right there. You basically buy a pass that says that you can do anything you want anytime, and therefore you don't really have to plan it. If you're trying to spend a sane amount of, if you're trying to spend the least you can, it's extremely complicated because you have to thread all these needles about when things are available, when you can book certain things, which rides you can and can't access at certain times, and whether you pay extra, and this is sort of a critical piece of the whole thing, whether you're going to and whether you need to pay extra in order to be able to access the rides in addition to the pass that gets you into the park. All of that is logistics that has to kind of be dealt with. There are literally expert consultants out there in the world that help people manage the complexity of a Disney trip. And so Scarlett, as a solo player, a bus driver from an exurb of Washington, D.C., did an absolutely bang-up job of making it happen. And yet, if you have one or two things go wrong along the way, and she had a few hiccups, you'll miss all kinds of stuff and rides that you can't get on, et cetera. So the bill was ultimately what she knew it would be for the trip, which was huge. From her perspective, it was worth it. But we tell the story in the piece of both Scarlett and her group. And then what does it look like if you just spend all the money? And in that case, it's just a piece of cake. The whole thing is a breeze.
Here you're talking about logistics as a major part of any Disney World trip, unless you want to pay a lot. And you emphasize this as you write about what you call a pecking order that exists at Disney World that favors the big spenders. You write, the system dispenses front-of-the-line spots and gives priority to travelers who book a guide, purchase expensive passes, or stay at a Disney property. And in your comments just now, you mentioned pay extra. So in addition to the logistics, you have the option to just pay to make those logistical problems go away. And that does create this pecking order within the park. How does that look if you visit the park? Can you see that?
So Disney is good at structuring the physical park in a way that makes the pecking order blend in and not jump out at you as much. So basically the older rides like Space Mountain were built without the idea that this would ever happen. And so when they did put it in, physical constraints are such that on Space Mountain, there's a line that's just empty and people are flying down that thing. And then there's a line where everybody's just standing there. They're right next to each other. So for the newer ones or for ones where they've been able to do adjustments, like they're building this in so that nobody can tell it's happening. But there are definitely places where you can see it.
in the comments to the Times piece, I remember reading some of the commenters saying things like, what message does it give to kids who are waiting in line along with everybody else? And then they look in the fast lane and see the big spenders just zoom past them and have no line. The message that they might internalize is, you're not as good as those people.
I think that's one thing on the kids. Here's the other thing. The kids that are flying past the crowd are very definitely aware of what's going on. I think that the impact may be on the kids who are just like, who expect to fly through, who just live in a world where they simply fly past all of, because it's not just Disney. These are the kids that went through TSA PreCheck with their parents, or it was clear or whatever. They're sitting in first class potentially when they fly down. They, you know, they're in the lounge. They, you know, and so like everything that they experience is of that kind. We're creating, and I didn't quite get into this, but you know, the positioning of the piece and the title had to do with decline of the middle class, which I think is interesting. Look, this is part of our establishment or reification or structuring of class. Like as Americans, we've always lived with the polite fiction that we don't have classes. And I think that is not something that will necessarily persist forever. And we increasingly have a layer of people who perhaps from the youngest age, simply have assumed that they get platinum card treatment all the time.
And of course, here you're using Disney World as an example. That I think what we're supposed to take away from the story is not that this is what's happening at Disney, but rather this is what's happening across the economy. And let's use Disney World as a case in point. But in the case of Disney, the corporation, you did write that this represents a change for that company, because Disney World used to offer an experience across income and wealth levels intentionally. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that Disney had a motto that read, everyone is a VIP. You write that an employee handbook from the 1950s quotes Walt Disney as saying, we roll out the red carpet for the Jones family from Joliet just as we would, with a few embellishments, for the Eisenhowers from Palm Springs. So Disney seems to have changed its own policy towards rolling out the red carpet for everybody. And in fact, listeners who haven't been to Disney in a while, maybe they went to Disney World, you know, 10, 20 years ago, they might still remember that as an experience that was largely shared by everyone as a common experience who came to the park. Now it's just very different. What happened within Disney to change that?
A way of telling this story that I think is sort of more positive towards Disney in a sense is Disney starts with the mass market thing. Disneyland is created in roughly 1955. Disney World in Orlando comes out in the early 70s. It was regarded as expensive, but also achievable. It was more than you'd expect to pay just because people hadn't developed amusement parks like that before. But it was a mass market product. As you go along, what happens is massive explosion in the number of families that have very high incomes. You know, around 2000, for example, other theme parks started to actually do some of the stuff that Disney refused to do for about 20 years, which was to give special lanes and special passes. This is the sort of thing that we've seen happening in airlines for a long time. And so airlines probably were on the front end of that sort of stratification model. Disney didn't do it. And so the notable thing about Disney was that they held out. I think they underestimated how much money they were leaving on the table by not selling special access. Like, hey, if you pay us more, we'll send you to the front of the line. This had been suggested as early as the 1990s. Michael Eisner at the time was against it. It was the economic crisis that, you know, COVID affected every industry differently. The theme park industry, obviously, had a bit of a moment in 2020. And so they had an absolute economic crater that they were looking at. So when they were able to open the parks after COVID, they very quickly did what was obviously a revenue opportunity for them 20 years before. I think they were probably shocked at just like they sold out every flavor of premium access from the moment they've offered it. And then they continue to make the prices for premium access higher and they continue to sell out just about every day. So they're making a huge amount of money by selling that premium access. I think they're still looking for the upper boundary of what people are willing to pay.
The piece, again, is called Disney and the Decline of America's Middle Class. I want to talk about that disappearance, or at least dimming, of the American middle class, because that's one of the threads throughout this piece. You're writing about how the middle class seems to be disappearing, and it's being replaced by a new two-tier system, the haves and the have-nots, and less in the middle. And I would put this in the language of this show as the tech oligarchs and the elites who support them as the haves, and then the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we can talk a little bit about this affluent class, the haves. You write that in the 2020s, the growing ranks of the affluent presented a profit source that could not be ignored. You're talking about companies that are serving the affluent.
Mm-hmm.
In 1992, you write, there were 88,000 households worth $20 million or more in 2022 dollars. By 2022, okay, so instead of 88,000, there were now 644,000 households worth $20 million or more. Those who could pay almost anything for a vacation were becoming their own mass market. There it is, an excellent terse summary of mm-hmm. what's happening in the formation of this bifurcated experience that Disney and airlines and others are now tending to offer, because there are so many super affluent households now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would point out, too, that like that threshold, which is at the 20 million or more level, 20 million is an awful lot, right? So that's 644,000, right? So 644,000 households have 20 million or more. And so it just, that's the thing that's changed. And so when you look at it from the company's perspective, if it's a consumer facing company, the amount of disposable income that lives in those households is just massive. And to try and make money by selling to the median household is just a ton of work and not really worth it.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We're halfway through my interview with Dan Carell, talking about his story in the New York Times about Disney and the disappearance of the middle class. And as I said in my introductory remarks, it's really not about Disney World. What we're talking about is what's happening in our big tech-dominated economy as it's turning into a two-tier system. The big tech oligarchs and the people who serve them on one side, and everybody else on the other side. And it's interesting to see how it plays out in something as, I don't know, as everyday or pedestrian as theme park design. But as Dan said, we can also see it in airlines and other experiences that people have day to day. And of course, in the incredible price rises we've seen in so many areas. Let's go ahead and listen to the second half of this interview with Dan Carell and dive into it a bit more here on Tectonic. Let's talk about how technology has impacted this, or has helped drive this transition. As I said before, in the language of this show, we talk about the tech oligarchs and their handlers as comprising the elite class right now. And technology indeed plays a part in this story you're telling from Disney World. Here's what you write about an app at Disney. In 2012, the My Disney Experience app gave guests an easy way to check wait times, show times, restaurant bookings, and more. In return, Disney gained a trove of information on exactly where guests went, what they purchased, and how much they spent. More than ever before, Disney and companies like it have access to data showing them who was willing to spend what for which experiences. And then you quote someone who says, Disney is an analytics company that happens to do movies and parks. Okay, tell us Dan, about how surveillance and data analytics are so important to Disney.
Yeah, and to your point, like it's Disney and it's kind of everybody else too. So for consumer-facing companies, one thing I'd point out is that the first thing to notice about large organizations has historically been how incredibly not very organized they are. Like the person on the street, so to speak, you know, we kind of just assume that they've got their act together and they've got all these data sets and they know what's going on. Overall, that tends not to be true. The thing about apps and also like loyalty programs, so you join some loyalty program, it could be for your grocery store, it could be for an airline. Apps and loyalty programs all come with terms and conditions that are really the point from the company's perspective that allow the company to track you as a unit. And so, for example, and without getting into the details, like when you swipe a credit card at a store, you'd be kind of surprised actually how little they know about you as a result of that, the store. The credit card company tends to know a good deal more, but they don't share it with others for a lot of reasons. And so there's this kind of fragmented environment. When you join the grocery store's loyalty program, that gives them the ability to track your stuff. Well, okay, so Disney, they launched the app, you do the thing, you download the app, you consent to the terms and conditions. You would know more about this than me, Mark, but I'm just going to go ahead and assume that they are entitled to my first child, right? Like, you should basically figure that when you just accept that, you know, adhesion contract, it's probably the case. And so they've got the right and the ability to physically, I mean, at this point, right, there's GPS data, there's all this stuff. They know exactly what you're interested in, what you clicked on, what you didn't click on, what you bought, how much you spent, all this kind of stuff. I mean, look, if you, I should have checked this out. I don't know if you could walk up to the gate. I'm guessing you could walk up to the gate and pay cash, like US Federal Reserve notes, to Disney to go in. I guess you could. And if you did that, then they wouldn't really have a clue about you. If you paid with a credit card and didn't join any kind of an app or membership thing with them, again, I think they wouldn't know that much about you. But that's not really how anything works these days, right? Like, I don't know what percentage of people go in there without downloading the app, et cetera. But that's like the whole system runs on that app.
Well, if I read your story right, Dan, if someone shows up and they pay cash, if Disney allows that, then they let them into the park. All of the ways that you can skip lines or have a faster experience are all going to be predicated on you using an app, having a surveillance device that runs.
I'm pretty sure you wouldn't be able to do the, what they call it, lightning lane and that kind of stuff. Yeah, I don't think there's a way of doing that.
So you're just going to be moldering away at the back of every line forever because you paid cash and have retained your privacy to some extent.
Yeah, I mean, what really happens is you basically defer off of the ones that have the super long lines, which, you know, by evidence of the line, are the maybe better ones or the more popular ones. You're gonna default into the stuff that has shorter lines. Like, that's just like what happens in practice. And so you'll go, you'll pay the entry, you'll be there, and you'll do stuff that at least by acclamation of public interest is maybe less interesting. So it's what I would say is right now, what you can do is buy the version of Disney World that's least popular by just paying the entry fee and not paying any more, or you can pay the entry fee and pay extra and get the version of Disney that's more popular, right? Depending on how much you're willing to pay. And apparently I didn't go on Rise of the Resistance, which is the Star Wars thing. But apparently it's just absolutely like shockingly amazing. And realistically, to get on the thing, you need to pay extra.
That's where we're headed. Sure, pay cash. You can ride the teacups all day if you like. Or if you want the cool new Star Wars branded shiny experience, you need to pay via an app. Give us all of your information, accept the terms and conditions, and then pay extra via an app. And then how about pay a little bit more for a guide and then you'll get in? I mean, the thing that I really appreciate about this story, again, it's not to pick on Disney or Disney World. If people like Disney World, you know, that's fine. I just like that you are painting a picture of what's happening everywhere in the economy as exemplified by this one experience in Orlando. And what's happening is that we have a two-tier system where the people who have benefited the most in the economy over the last 20 years, largely due to their involvement in tech or something adjacent to big tech, can have the disposable income, as you say, to go anywhere, to skip any line, to do whatever they want, to have a friction-free, convenient experience for them. For everybody else, they have to give up their privacy, deal with logistics, and take a back seat to the elite. I mean, whether it's Disney World or airlines, or I don't know where else this is going to start popping up soon, the technology has both made this bifurcation possible, and it continues to accelerate the widening gap in inequality.
I would say, you know, as a basic lens for where will it happen, you know, where does it happen and where will it happen? Anywhere demand exceeds supply in any way. The thing with Disney World is it's a physical place with physical constraints. Only so many, you know, Space Mountain was built in whatever year, but even for the new rides, right, only so many humans can go through that thing in an hour, period. Like, that's just it. And so it's rate limited. And if you lived in a world at Disney World where they didn't have that many people coming, they wouldn't be able, they could offer this, but who would buy it, right? It wouldn't change the experience. So, you know, congestion pricing, whether it's London or whether it's the thing that they were going to do in New York, that kind of stuff. So anywhere you have, you know, an aperture that you got to go through physically, or whether it's physical or not, where demand exceeds supply, whenever you have that in a persistent way, more dollars chasing arguably the same number of available resources, you're going to see it. And so there are other, if you're going to think through, will this happen in this field? Last thing I'll say on this one is, in some fields, like live entertainment, there's nothing more stratified than an orchestra seating chart or Shakespeare's Globe. But those are kind of innately somewhat small venues for like orchestra or symphony or that, you know, opera. There's what, a few thousand people in there max. And so those things, and some seats are far better than others. And so any environment that kind of looks like that, you're going to get this kind of increasingly explicit stratification that looks like the old orchestra seating chart, but it's happening everywhere.
Yeah, the Globe Theater example is a good one. That was built, what, 500 years ago or so?
Yep.
Maybe even when Euripides was performing his plays in ancient Greece, we had stratification. I don't know how the Greek theater worked, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were better and worse seats, more expensive, less expensive seats there. I don't know. I feel like what's happening today, although it's related to that in that there's stratification naturally when demand exceeds supply, it seems like the scale of this is out of whack. Because as you point out in the piece, Disney used to have a more general purpose invitation to its guests, and now it doesn't. I recently had on the show Megan Greenwell, who wrote a book about private equity called Bad Company. And I wanted to have Megan on the show because I thought it did such a good job of telling four stories of this insane stratification. I liked how you summarized the whole story near the end of the article. You write, "The economics of appealing to the middle class aren't what they used to be. The market and increasingly the culture is dominated by the affluent. And technology is enabling companies to see these previously invisible class divides and act on them. Based on what we earn, we see different ads, stand in different lines, eat different food, stay in different hotels, watch the parade from different sections, and on and on. What's profitable today is not unification, it's segmentation." So well put in just a few sentences. Do you think the future, Dan, is more and more segmentation? Do you think these divides are going to get wider?
Well, let me just start with the caveat that I think that we're on the front end of a period of rapid change. You know, you go through periods of stability and periods of change, and innovation isn't really linear. It's very lumpy. I think we're on the front end, very obviously on the front end with large language model, AI, of rapid change. And it is conceivable that that will actually level the playing field in some way that I can't imagine or don't know. But for the most part, when you throw more capital-intensive labor-saving devices into the system, I would expect the concentrations of wealth, I would expect that to grow And I think that, yeah, the divide probably becomes more stark. So then, is there more segmentation? I would expect it because AI not only will be an engine of that wealth capture, but it will also itself make it easier to analyze the data and to see who's what and to tailor offerings so that we do perhaps end up living in a more different worlds, right? Like we have fewer shared cultural experiences and fewer shared cultural spaces, and that people will, and like my example earlier, or your example earlier of like the child who is the one who has the Lightning Lane premium pass, whatever, develops from the get-go a set of expectations about how the world works that are not common to 60% or whatever, 80% of the population.
I just wanted to bring up one other thing about this stratification. Even though we don't use Instagram or any Zuckerberg products here at Tectonic, I will read this excerpt and ask you about an Instagram hashtag, I guess, that you write about. You write, "Compared with the past, a Disney trip is more expensive, but perhaps more important, it feels much more expensive because at every turn, one is being invited to level up and spend more. Thanks to social media, we can now see the experiences that divide us. Go to Instagram and search for hashtag Club33, the invitation-only clubs hidden within Disney properties. What you see there will not make you feel a kinship with your fellow man unless you are one of the very few invited in." Well, Dan, since I don't use Instagram and I'm not going to look up hashtag Club33, if that's how you say it, what would I see there if I looked it up?
Four-course Michelin star type meals with $100 wine pairings with each course, absolute luxury thing. It's a physical place inside. Not every Disney property around the world has one, but many, I think maybe most do. And it's the kind of thing that costs, and I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but it's sort of like 50 or 80,000 to join, and then there's an annual member, so it's a little like a country club deal. And it's wildly luxury, high-end. You have to have very real money in order to be a member of Club 33. And it is still secret and hidden, and people, know where it is if they know. But if you were to look at it and say, is there an entrance there? You'd say, no, there's nothing there. But actually, that's Club 33.
Well, Dan, I really appreciate you spending some time with us. This was a very thoughtful essay, and I'll echo what some of the comments said on the Times site, which was that this should be required reading for anybody who wants to understand the economy right now. The article is called Disney and the Decline of America's Middle Class. Again, I'm going to put a link to that on the playlist for today's show. Dan Carell, thanks again for spending some time with us.
Mark, thank you. It's fun, and great to be on the show and great to have the conversation.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. We just heard my interview with Dan Carell, who wrote a piece in the New York Times called Disney and the Decline of America's Middle Class. An article I liked a lot. I didn't like the conclusions. I mean, I agree with him, but I'm sorry to see this stratification occurring all over the economy, not just in Disney World. If you're interested in reading the piece, there's a gift link on the playlist. If you go to tectonic.fm, you can find it. That's T-E-C-H tonic.fm. And then just click the link for the episode on widening inequality with Dan Carell. I really appreciated this one quote. I mean, there are a number of things in the article I liked, but I want to highlight this quote again that I brought up in the interview. Disney is an analytics company that happens to do movies and parks, because that basic structure, that such and such company is an analytics company that happens to do, what everyone thinks they do, that's a good way of describing many companies in business today. It makes me think of that recent episode with Megan Greenwell about private equity, because when we talked about hospitals and hospital systems, she pointed out something very similar, that the hospitals, as they're being bought and run by private equity companies, the hospitals transform from primarily being an organization about delivering care to patients and families and communities into an organization that delivers profit to the private equity owner and happens to have doctors, nurses, and patients walking around in a building. You see, there is a change in the basic identity of these organizations when data and money become the primary driver of all of the activity and all of the leadership decisions. And that's certainly what's happened in Disney and in other companies. And the inevitable result of that, as I was just speaking with Dan about, is the stratification, the widening inequality. Because as the companies rely more on the surveillance data, they're able to segment the customer base and create tiers, two tiers, one for the super wealthy and then one for everybody else. So in the case of a theme park, the super wealthy are invited, which they gladly accept the invitation, to pay exorbitant amounts to skip the lines and have these amazing four-course meals and stay in these great properties right next to the theme park, whereas everyone else waits in line and eats the fast food and stays in a property far away. That bifurcation plays again and again throughout the economy as companies are relying more on their surveillance engines. Another part of that surveillance regime, by the way, that came up in the interview, is that you're really not allowed to pay cash anymore. I mean, as Dan said, you know, maybe you could show up to the gate and pay cash, but if you pay cash, then you're not using your surveillance phone and you're not accepting the terms and conditions to their surveillance app, which takes you out from any of the offered benefits of skipping lines or getting extra information. Essentially, you need a surveillance device in order to engage in many of the consumer-facing experiences that we've got in the economy today. Even though a lot of cities and I believe states now have laws on the books that say companies have to accept cash. You cannot require people to use a surveillance device in order to access your product or your service. But in practice, what are you going to do when the companies make it so inconvenient for you to try to do business with them without using a surveillance device? So that pushes even more people into the surveillance regime because they're thinking, well, if I want privacy, I'm going to have a horrible experience. I'm going to be waiting in line all day. So yeah, I'll just pull out my surveillance device. I have no choice but to click accept on these terms and conditions. And then the company's got them. And what that allows the companies to do is to engage in surveillance pricing. This is the practice of delivering different prices to different customers based on what the company knows about each customer after they have surveilled them. So one link that I've put on the playlist, this is from Al Jazeera from October 15, 2025, talking about surveillance pricing. The story says, quote, retailers can monitor your online behavior by recording what you click on, your browsing time, location, and device choice, and combine all this with your purchase history to determine your price sensitivity. To do all of this, they use AI surveillance tools to produce pricing recommendations. So that's the heart of surveillance pricing. The companies have access to your surveillance dossier based on where you've been and what else you've bought and what you have posted on social media. I mean, people are gladly and willingly surveilling themselves and every instant of their lives via social media on these surveillance devices. And the companies gladly hoover that up, analyze it through their AI analytics engine, and they raise or lower the prices to the point where they're going to extract a maximal amount of profit out of each individual customer. And since you are transacting with the company, you know, the retailer, the theme park, the airline, whatever, since you're transacting with a company through your surveillance device individually, you can't see what your neighbor got priced, what they got charged. You can't see anyone else's price. You can only see your own. And you either take it or leave it. You can't negotiate. You are stuck. You know, you're facing this this faceless AI surveillance engine through this little glowing rectangle in your hand. And if you want the product, the service, the airline ticket, you've got to accept it. Otherwise, maybe you can walk or pay cash and wait in line all day. So one example of this playing out right now is one of the major airlines here in the U.S. is Delta Airlines. And from Futurism, and I think it was originally in Fortune back in July 2025, it was reported, Delta is looking to push the boundaries of how much passengers are willing to shell out for a plane ticket. By the end of 2025, Delta hopes to price 20% of its tickets individually using AI. So this is just the barest, newest introduction of surveillance pricing in 2025, and Delta wants by the end of the year to price 20% of their airline tickets, 20% already using surveillance pricing. That is inevitably going to grow, and it's going to be adopted by other airlines as well as other companies outside the airlines. But as Dan said, the airlines have really been pioneers in the use of technology and surveillance in order to drive this widening inequality, all drawing on AI engines and surveillance platforms provided to them by big tech, the same five companies that have so generously donated to the current occupant to destroy the East Wing of the White House. So you see how this connects. The blob, as I've called it, this state and big tech power, this combination of power and wealth that we have never seen in this country or any other, this incredible accumulation of influence, wealth, power that is shared by the richest and most powerful people in the world is coming downstream to other industries such as airlines and theme parks, such that everybody is now rolling out surveillance required services and surveillance pricing in each step, whether it's a pricing a plane ticket or pricing a shirt at some retail store or pricing a theme park, you know, add-on to go to the special new ride. Every step of the way, it's stratifying us even more. It's widening the inequality even more. And upstream of all of that, the prime movers in all of this is big tech. Their growth at any cost ethos, the complete lack of ethics, the total lack of concern as to the outcomes to democracy or community or any sense of fairness in the economy, all of that starts in Silicon Valley. And it comes out to all of the other companies that willingly adopt it and then roll it out to the rest of us such that we are left with a stratified society. And if you want another example of how this two-tier system plays out, there was an interesting article in the New York Times. This is from October 4, 2025. A gift link to this story as well on the playlist at tectonic.fm. The article is called "Your Wealthiest Friend Has a Private Concierge." So this is a little slice of life, how the other half lives kind of thing. This is what this story says. This is a quick excerpt I put on the playlist. Private concierges are an expensive team of dedicated assistants paid to do your bidding. For up to $75,000 per year, these firms will book impossible-to-get dinner reservations, procure your child's birthday present, or personally courier your beach wardrobe from England to the Maldives over the holidays. Isn't that nice? for just the mere subscription cost of $75,000 a year, you could have a private concierge procure the perfect birthday present for your kid. The article goes on. Concierge firms compete in offering hyper-personalization. There's the personalization from surveillance again. knowing and acting upon clients' individual quirks, desires, tastes, and bothers. One person who's quoted says, say we've booked you at a restaurant, and we know you are a sushi fanatic, so there's tuna tartare waiting for you at the table when you arrive. Increasingly, firms partner with luxury brands like Sotheby's, Formula One, and Aston Martin. In this way, they can offer members exclusive and red carpet access to events like the U.S. Open or New York Fashion Week, or access to hard-to-acquire luxury products. So here we're seeing the outcome of this two-tier system, what Dan Carell and I were talking about, that companies now, they feel like they have to offer a tier of their service for the ultra wealthy, because if they don't, they're going to be leaving so much money on the table that they're not going to have, they perceive, they're not going to have enough money to pursue their own investments or pay their own employees and so on. So companies are feeling pressured. They perceive the need to participate in this ongoing stratification of the economy by offering crazily expensive services, like we're seeing these private concierges and having partnerships with Sotheby's and Formula One and so on. And meanwhile, what we see is that, as I talked about with Megan Greenwell, the march of private equity in order to roll into healthcare continues apace. So while the ultra wealthy, as Dan was writing about it in the story, say 20 million or more are getting private concierges and they have sushi, tuna tartare waiting for them at the table, most people have to live with normal services without the private concierges. And one area that everybody intersects with at some point is the healthcare system. And here in the U.S., there was an interesting article, again, in the New York Times. There's a GIF link on the playlist. This is from October 4, 2025. Get this headline: How Private Equity Oversees the Ethics of Drug Research. And the article says that many drug trials now are vetted by companies with ties to the drug makers, raising concerns about conflicts of interest and patient safety. Now, it says the first ethics panels created in response to testing scandals in the 60s and 70s, the first ethics panels were nonprofits based at universities and hospitals. But in recent years, private equity investors have increasingly reshaped them as for-profit endeavors. For drug companies racing to develop the next blockbuster, private equity promised quicker, more efficient reviews. At the same time, private equity ownership has driven the board's expansion far beyond their original watchdog role. So what do you think is going to happen, friends, as private equity continues to own more and more of the healthcare system, including drug trials in which the companies they own and the companies vetting the drugs are under the same owner? This stratification is only going to increase. And Matt Stoller writes about this on October 26, 2025, in his big newsletter. Just continue with the healthcare theme here. He's writing about the upcoming price increases in healthcare premiums. And I say upcoming, of course, I'm well aware that healthcare premiums have gone up and up and up and up every year, and they are likely to take another big jump in the next year. And this is what Matt Stoller writes. He writes, there's data coming out about the forthcoming changes in the price of health insurance premiums, and the numbers are jaw-dropping. Here's the Wall Street Journal, which wrote the cost is now $27,000 for a family plan, according to a study that came out recently. That's a jump of 6%, I think, in 1 year. And healthcare costs were up 7% for the two preceding years. And another major report of healthcare costs indicated that the cost for an average family of four in 2025 is $35,000. And here's the punchline, friends. That amount, $35,000, is three times what it was in 2005. So what normal families used to pay for a family of four for health insurance premiums has skyrocketed. This is all part of the same system, all part of the same stratification in the economy that we've been talking about this hour. Stoller continues. America spends $1.5 trillion a year on hospitals, and hospital spending grew at 10% in 2023, 9% in 2024. 2025 is going to be another massive year. These go to big city academic hospitals, not the rural ones closing down. When you get, and he continues, by the way, because these are nonprofits and seen as charity, donors give money to these hospitals. They often get huge tax concessions, and they use their cash to buy up doctors' practices and slap patients with even higher prices. And then he continues a little later. When you get your premium increase notification, you will not hear about the urology professor at the University of Miami paid $4 million a year, or the salary paid to the guy playing the piano in a marble medical chateau. You won't hear about the state-granted monopoly called Apexus, which takes a cut of every drug purchased by most hospitals through a special government discount plan called 340B. Again, what I'm trying to do, friends, here is paint you a picture of the stratification that the rest of us are paying more and more and more for basic cost of living. And you have to ask, where is the money going? Where is the money and power rolling up to? And we've discussed what the answer is. It's going up to that tiny, tiny little class. We need better regulations. And please, if we could just get some competent political leadership and we could do something about this. The last article that I want to cover very quickly before I close is a reminder about one other basic reality of life, which is food. And there was an article in the Times, October 26, 2025. There's a gift link on the playlist at tectonic.fm. The headline is, Food Banks Brace for Overwhelming Demand as SNAP Cutoff Looms. And the story says that the administration of the current occupant, slashing the federal workforce earlier this year, has already driven up food insecurity in many areas. And then this recent government shutdown cut off paychecks for most of those who still had government jobs. And it goes on to talk about this food distribution event. It says cars lined up for blocks in Beltsville, Maryland. This is not far from Washington, D.C. For blocks in Beltsville, Maryland on Saturday, waiting at one of several food distribution events that this group has held for federal employees who have gone weeks without wages. After 45 minutes and 320 boxes given away, the Beltsville site ran out of food, and everyone who was still in line had to drive away empty-handed. So I want you to imagine this, friends. In one part of the economy, we have private concierges where people are paying $75,000 a year so that they can have the fresh tuna tartare at their table when they get to their favorite sushi restaurant, or to procure the perfect birthday gift for their child. And on the other side of the economy, we have federal workers, U.S. federal workers, who are food insecure, who are running out of food, literally running out of food, who are lining up in their cars and waiting for hours at a food distribution event, hoping to get some food so they can get through their next week, their next month, and they're being turned away. That, I think, is as stark an image of the two sides of the economy as I can think of. And I appreciate Dan Carell writing that piece on Disney to give us an example to explore how big tech's surveillance regime has played an important part, a necessary part, in the stratification of this economy. And I hope you found that interesting. Until next time, friends, you know what to do. Avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. And a couple days ago, I went to this great award show called the Dannys, where disabled musicians were given awards for their musical achievements. And I wanted to play this song by Joel Chapman, who performed there. It's called From the Bedroom to the Bathroom. And it's a story about his difficulty getting coverage for a wheelchair. He's disabled, needs a wheelchair, and you'll hear his story in this song. Have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next time.
When I was 4 years old, my best friend at daycare asked me, "Why do you use crunches, Joel?" And I answered, "Because I walk. Because I walk." This was very obvious to me. The medical details weren't that important. So now when insurance companies ask me, "Why do you use wheelchairs, Joel?" "Because you walk. Because you walk." Feels like I'm talking to a 4-year-old. Are you curious about my body? Do you wonder how I wash my hair? Do you want to know how true it is that I really need this chair? You and the whole world. So anyway, when insurance companies ask me, "Why do you need wheelchairs, Joel?" Do you want to know why they deny me? Because I walk from the bedroom to the bathroom. Because I walk from the bedroom to the bathroom. When I was 10 years old, a reporter came to the house and asked me, "How do you play piano, Joel?" And I answered, "I just kind of go." I just kind of go. This is a verbatim quote from the first time I was ever published in a newspaper. Are you curious about my body? Do you wonder how it stands? Do you want to know which joints are bent or how I use my hands? You and the whole world. When I was 8 years old, when I was 17, when I was 12, when I was 20, when I was 30. Why do you use wheelchairs, Joel? The older I get, the more I look up to that 4-year-old. Because I walk. Because I walk. Don't you see the problem? For every test you proctor, I also have to prove it to my own primary doctor. For everything I need, for medication, for a ramp, I always have to plead with the people in charge of a stamp. You and the whole world. Because I walk. Because I walk. Because I walk from the bedroom to the bathroom. Because I walk from the bedroom to the bathroom. From the bedroom to the bathroom. To the bathroom. To the bathroom. Are you curious about my body?